Okay, this is Karen Brewster, and today is September 5th, 2025, and I'm here with Leslie Schick at her home in Anchorage, Alaska, and this is for the Iditarod National Historic Trail Project Jukebox. And talk to Leslie a little bit about her role with the Trail Alliance and easement program and all things trail related. So. Thank you, Leslie, for
thank you
meeting me and helping us with this project. Mm-hmm. So just to get us started, tell me a little bit about yourself, your background, how you ended up here in Anchorage.
I came up to Anchorage in 92 for college. I was raised in Oregon and Washington, but I was coming up from Washington State. Mm-hmm. My major was in anthropology, but archaeology, and with a minor in geology. And strangely enough, almost all my professional work, except for one job, has been on the Iditarod.
Oh.
including the labs, the field work in college. Eventually, after graduating, my initial field work, while in college, on the Chief Wasilla site, mm-hmm. Which is along Cottonwood Creek, along the trail. And then I went to grad school, and then I volunteered for the borough over at Kinnick.
Okay.
Kind of across the highway from the museum.
The Transportation Museum? What museum?
The Kinnick Museum.
Oh, okay.
And I think a year after that, soon after that, in 2000, I was hired by the Forest Service.
The dog walking.
Yeah.
Okay.
And as an archaeologist. And all the job, even with the borough, I was volunteering as an archaeologist. And then one of my jobs, I was a crew chief and lead archaeologist. And one of my jobs was as the lead archaeologist for the Forest Service Iditarod project, which included surveying the historic alignment as well as the commemorative alignments that the Forest Service was proposing.
And that would be on the southern portion?
The southern, what's called the Southern Trek.
Right, so between here and Seward or Eagle River?
Girdwood to Seward.
Yeah, okay.
Or Crow Pass, kind of. Okay.
Yeah, I was thinking about that there was the historic route and then there's a sort of the ceremonial.
Yeah.
There's a different route in that part of the trail.
Well, some spots it's right on, like Johnson Pass is still the historic route.
Uh-huh.
So that alignment, you are on the historic trail, but there's other parts that are now the Seward Highway or the Alaska Railroad, and it's illegal to hike on the Alaska Railroad. And for those, they did have what are called commemorative routes, which you're allowed to do under the National Trails Act, which is to actually have a legal hiking route off the highway or railroad.
Okay. So somebody cut trail through there?
It depends on the segment. So if you're, let's say, near Seward, like off of Nash Road, that's a historic trail. So you're on what's called the Bear Lake Trail.
Oh, right.
Up to mile 12. So even though it's commemorative, it is also itself a historic trail.
Right.
And then there's other sections where they're connecting to historic trails that are new, and then other alignments that are either new completely or they haven't been there in 50 or 70 years.
Right.
On maps, it shows there's a trail there, but no one's been using it since 1920.
Right. And so did the Forest Service go in and break out these trail sections for the commemorative parts?
Yeah, initially they would just flag them. So what would happen is you'd have the recreation planners flagging it, and then you would have then the specialists, the ologists, of various going through, plus engineers. And then the engineers would a lot of times say, yeah, it's nice that this is historic and you want to put it here, but this is really not safely where you should put a trail.
Right.
And then other times they might, where since it's commemorative, maybe they want to go near a waterfall or have an overlook. Or they realize we put the trailhead, people will make the trail go there.
Right.
So it just depends. And so a lot of times, some places you would have one alignment or one, you're on a historic trail, that's where it's going to be. In others, they would have, it's one of these three. And once we get the input from everybody, we'll make a determination. But as the archaeologist, you had to survey all three.
Oh, okay. Because they were possible options.
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't think about that archaeologists surveyed. I think about the trail from Kinnick to Nome, mm-hmm. and I forget about sort of the southern part, and that you would have had to survey all that because it was new, quote unquote, new trail.
New or reestablished or being used differently.
Mm-hmm.
So like for the Bear Lake Trail, which is a developed trail, so they're not really building anything, but it would be like they're brushing and, you know, making it more obvious it's a Forest Service trail,
right,
instead of maintained by the users for
right.
the last 70 years.
Right.
And so we, you know, you would do that because you knew that they would be actually doing trail work.
Right. And so did the archaeological surveys uncover anything interesting?
Yeah, it depended on what area you were in. The funnest, I think, for all of the archaeologists on the project was, so the whistle stop, what the forest calls whistle stop, is also on the Iditarod Trail.
Okay.
And that was the funnest only because instead of you trying to look for a needle in a haystack, meaning going into the woods to try to find something small or things that people did,
uh-huh.
Because you were in what was called the Loop District, we were, you know, we came across tunnel number one. We found the old snow sheds, like things that are large. And there's like some of the old water stations. One of the tanks is still there.
Huh. For the steam, for the trains,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
But often an alignment that's no longer used.
Oh.
But that was just kind of nice to like where you're documenting incredibly large scale.
Yes.
items. And then to see them. And it was also interesting because we would, you know, get on the train when we were done. And you would kind of at the same time overhear like the narrative.
Oh.
And they would be like, yes, this pristine valley after we just went and documented all this large scale, completely changing of the valley that was done 100 years earlier.
Yeah. So the train has taken a different route since it was put in originally?
Well, the steam trains, so going up the pass and over by Spencer Glacier,
uh-huh.
they had what was called the Loop District. They had to do a big, giant loop.
Yeah, I've seen pictures of that.
In an S-curve. So they have the S-curve still. So if you go up there, you do the big curve
mm-hmm.
still. But when it was steam engines, they had to have a full-on loop.
Okay.
Once it became diesel, they could take out the loop
okay.
and just keep the S.
Curve. Okay. Yeah, and I think I've seen pictures where it was, on trestle.
Mm-hmm. And so we had to, you know, ford the river because the trestle isn't there to a certain extent. But it was just really neat to document.
Yeah.
Like full on. You know, we could actually say people would, even the railroad and older employees would tell us stories of like there's stuff in tunnel number one. There isn't, except for train tracks.
Did you find anything, you know, those needles in the haystack, anything else hidden away out there in the woods?
Yeah, depending on what section we were, you'd find remnants of cabins. I think we only found one actual cabin. And if we were serving along the highway, because the highway has also been realigned, so if we were along the old alignment, we would actually find car crashes.
Oh.
But ones of like coupes and like 1930s cars.
Right.
That were like went off the road and they were just left there.
Right.
And So we would do that. We did find a, a couple native sites along the way. It just depended on where you were, because you were in an area that people lived in.
Right.
And so we did, if you were on, if we were along the rail alignment, we did find entire camps, construction camps, where mm-hmm. they were. It just depended on what segment you always found something. It just depended on.
How much of a segment did you do at a time? I mean, like, it was a summer field season, right?
Yeah, so the whistle stop, we did that all in one season with three crews simultaneously. Wow. So I had to coordinate multiple ones, and that was the only way to get that done in a reasonable amount of time, because you were in an entire valley that didn't have a lot of work, versus if you're off the Seward Highway, some of the other projects would have happened that would have had survey work to help guide you.
Right. So like, even if the highway had been surveyed for a project, you had to go back and resurvey?
Yes and no. Sometimes it depended on where you were, but yes, because usually the alignment was getting off the right of way.
Oh, right.
But you use the surveys that could have been there for timber harvest or whatever project it was in the past, just to see what did they find and can we re-find it? Because a lot of the older projects, even if we're talking about like even the 90s, wouldn't have had GPS.
Oh, right.
And so you would find them just to correctly locate them by today's standards.
And did you find things that indicated the Iditarod Trail use period?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we found we went to like the Snoring Inn, which is a roadhouse that was there while it was in use, which was actually a lot of stuff was left there, and various other roadhouses. We also, and some things that people, I guess, don't realize were there, which was, what's now the Seward Nordic Ski Club. That ski area was put in 100 years ago. Huh. And the club is one of the oldest clubs.
Where's that?
It's at mile 12. And so we also, in surveying the Forest Service route, which was connecting to what was called the Golden Fin Trail, which is an old Forest Service trail, but it's a trail that the Forest Service stopped maintaining like in the 50s. So it's one they put in like the 20s.
Right.
But it was put in for skiing.
Oh, okay.
So it was put in for recreation from the railroad. Like, they would drop people off and they would go ski.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they had like a little tow rope for the actual hill.
Okay.
But then there were actual trails that are meant not for hiking, but primarily for winter use.
Yeah. Sort of like what they do at the Spencer Glacier, don't they? Kind of whistle stop. They leave people for the day and then mm-hmm. come back into the ski train. That's what mm-hmm. it's called. Right. Well, it's interesting that you still found roadhouse structures and things.
Yeah, and found that. Depending on where you were, we could find, like in Girdwood, we found a lot of mining. And other sections, we would find, I know we found like parts of giants and like old style mining equipment.
What are giants?
Giants, that was when the old style of placer mining, when you see photos where they have these big water guns.
Oh, right.
That's a giant.
Oh, okay.
And where they would like hose down a hillside to get the gravel out that then they would pan or process.
Right.
Yeah. And so depending on where we were, we could find stuff like that.
Interesting.
In holes that miners dug and...
old outhouses. I always like that archaeologists dig up old privies.
Mm-hmm.
And the things you find. So that was in what years you were doing that?
I did that until December of 2006. So it was 2000 or 2001. I know I was being paid in 2001 to 2006. I was an archaeologist with the Forest Service. Okay. And then in January of 2007, I moved from the Forest Service to the Iditarod easement project with the state.
Okay. And do you know When you were with the Forest Service, do you know about, you know, how the Forest Service got inspired to recognize the trail? Or they were sort of late to the game?
It depends on the part of the trail. I do know, you know, one part of it, especially near Girdwood and what's now the Winter Creek Trail, a lot of that funding came about because of an accident involving our senior senator at the time. So Senator Stevens fell and had to, I believe he had to be airlifted out. In his discussion with the Forest Service of why is the trail so bad, they said, well, it's on our deferred maintenance. We've been asking Congress for this money, but they've been saying no for decades. And then he actually did an earmark for that.
Oh, okay.
The actual Iditarod project with them was a full project proposal and NEPA analysis. That was separate, the full length. And Jamie Schmidt could probably be good with that. I mean, with the Forest Service, because I was the head for the archaeologists, which they called the Heritage Department, I would also be put on interpretive plan projects in various other overarching concepts for the Iditarod, that they would always put a heritage person on those panels.
Uh-huh.
And at that time, that was me.
And so what kind of things did those panels address? What were you involved with?
I can go turn that off in a second here. Well, for the interpretive plan, the trail does not have one. And so the Forest Service was trying to come up with a thematic design for at least the Southern Trek.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a new concept. They didn't have anything like, you know, all they had was the standard, you know, brown, you know, like kiosk. Like, we kind of all know what the Forest Service kiosks look like, where they're all, you know, the brown painted wood.
Right, with the logo.
With white lettering, and there's really no deviation. And so they actually do need like a plan to actually deviate from the Forest Service plan.
Oh, okay.
And so there's other places like, you know, the Trail of Blue Eyes has one where you see blue signs. That had to be a plan and approved in order to deviate from brown and green.
Pauses for a second. With the animal sounds in the background. Just says we're in somebody's house who has a cat and a dog. That's okay.
Mm-hmm.
So these interpretive plans you were talking about.
I think when I left, all we had was a draft.
Okay.
And we had various drafts. But I think they went off the drafts to plan, which is how the kiosk will kind of match along the Southern Trek.
So there are now signs along the Southern Trek?
In segments that they've actually finished.
Okay.
They're still in the process, I believe, of finishing it. And if you had an interview with somebody from the forest, like a current person, they could tell you. But I do believe there still needs some bridge, because in some areas they built the trail, but they didn't have the bridge money.
Right.
In other places, they had the bridge money and not the trail money.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
it's okay. What was I just going to say about the... being the heritage person, and what else that entailed?
Well, I was the archaeologist. You know, by heritage, that meant you were an archaeologist. We didn't have historians at the time. And so you would survey plan projects for the Forest Service or other people's projects that are have contracts with the Forest Service or approved projects. You know, they have a permit or a proposed lease type of thing. Where we had to go out and, you know, set up what's called the area of potential effect, and we would survey the whole area. At that time, the Chugach National Forest didn't have an approved plan with the State Historic Preservation Office. I believe they do now. And so what that meant was we had to do a 100% survey. So every AP of every project, we had no choice. We couldn't sample.
Okay.
We had to do a 100% survey. Wow. And so for this project, we had to figure out, okay, where are the alignments? Where do we think the area potential effect is? And then we had to 100% survey.
Right. So that's why I was wondering, like, you know, how many miles of trail could you do in a summer if you were doing it that comprehensively?
It depended on the number of employees we had. It took, I want to say, 4 years by the time, and I'm including the whistle stop
right
in there. But at the same time, a lot of times you would do one and then they would then have a reroute, or like the engineers would come back and it would end up needing to move farther than anybody thought.
Okay.
That was rare, but it did happen in a couple. And then also there were actually more alignments than proposed than today you would see on the ground. Like in Turnagain Pass, there was actually a third alignment mm-hmm. that was even higher up than what they're building or did build.
Uh-huh.
But we had to survey that, and that had no access. And so,
well, as you say,
you did a lot of bushwhacking to get to the project.
Yeah, it sounds like hard work doing that kind of survey work.
Yes and no. Being short in stature, I actually rather enjoyed it because I always called it the great equalizer. Because it was willow and alder were horrible for tall people.
Aren't they horrible for shorter people too? Or you could.
For willow, I was like the perfect height. I could just motor through the stuff. But a lot of the branches like hit like knee length for somebody who is taller.
Right.
So.
I never thought about that. I just think willow and alder are difficult no matter what.
No, I always did willow. I had an advantage, and then alder, everybody was at even keel.
Yeah.
It didn't matter how super in fit you are. you're going at the same pace as the right. slowest person.
Right. And then, and then I know, like, the BLM, you know, had this comprehensive plan that they came out with early on when the trail was designated mm-hmm. as a historic trail. And how did that jive with the Forest Service? Did you guys use that or what?
Yeah, so as a federal agency, we're required to. It's only optional for state and local government, you know, non-federal mm-hmm. entities. But the proposal to do a commemorative route is actually in the 1986 plan. So it was
okay.
already there that the Forest Service would actually be reestablishing trail.
So was the Forest Service involved in making that decision in 1986, or they would?
Yeah, they would have been a partner. Yeah. So it would have been, you know, BLM and the partners there, even the state was there.
Right.
Judy Bittner would be better.
Right. Oh, yeah. No, I was just wondering, because I know about the Comprehensive Management Plan, and now since we're talking about Forest Service, I'm like, oh, how did those two connect?
No, yeah. You, as a federal entity, we were required to follow
okay.
the Comprehensive Management Plan.
Okay, and then you did your own planning after that.
Yeah, and then the Forest Service would have its own forest plans, and then they would also have the NEPA and decision documents of the project itself.
Okay. Yeah, that's... For those of us not in those agencies, how all those plans and laws and stuff.
Yeah, you know,
it's
so
confusing.
A forest plan doesn't negate the comprehensive management plan.
Okay.
You just have to work. You have to use both of them.
Right. Okay.
And then you know area plans, which they have different names. I'll just say area plan to. As we go between agencies, then that's like the next tier down. But yes, you still have to, and usually the area plans will point and say this plan exists. You know, kind of like if you have a project in this area, look at this document.
Right. Okay. And now on all that surveying that you did, was there any ever a section where, because of what you guys found archaeologically, required a reroute of the proposed route, or that was only just because of the engineering?
No, it wasn't because of the just the engineering. So we did have segments where we found corduroy, and it wasn't really a reroute so much as can you move 5 feet? Like, you're still within the area.
Okay.
It's a fairly minor, and then it would also give the ability to do future interpretation if they so choose to do that. But especially like around Girdwood, also near Seward, like between Seward and Twelmont, we would actually find segments of corduroy.
And you need to explain to people what corduroy is.
So when the trail was still in use, and also remember that for the Forest Service commemorative route, they had segments they were using historic trails. And when we say trail, it might have been a road, meaning it had wagons on it.
Okay.
If it's that old. And so near Seward and also at Girdwood were, quote, trails like that. And so if you had a trail that was horribly muddy, but you needed to get wagons or cars or Model Ts on them, you would put logs across the muddy parts right next to each other and build kind of a wood surface that you could then drive your cart or wagon car on and not get stuck in the mud.
Right.
And that's called corduroy.
Okay. Thank you for explaining it for people who aren't aware. So yeah, you're right that would be an interesting historic interpretive thing. You could explain this is how this was used, and
and so a lot of it was more like, you know, don't dig this up,
right?
You know, please move 2 feet that way,
right?
You know, they weren't big reroutes,
right?
Not for this project, but other ones. If you come across like a village or something like that, then yeah, you'll have a big reroute because you don't want to take people right through that.
Right. You didn't find any of those kind of places?
No. And then when we were doing like Whistle Stop, we did tell them where the camps were so that then they could design it around that.
Right.
So they, again, weren't going right through
a
construction camp.
And did you ever come across any graves?
Because
those are things you certainly want to reroute around.
Not unknown ones. You know, there are some historic, like 1800s, early turn of the 20th century grave sites that we knew that we just had to go to see if we could relocate. Just to say, yes, it is here.
Right.
But that wasn't near, like they weren't planning on putting a trail there. It was in areas where the trail was always used.
Okay.
And I'm thinking, you know, if you're near like Summit Lake or Mill Creek, Mill Creek near Summit Lake is the original gold strike on the Kenai Peninsula.
Oh, okay.
It's still being mined today.
Oh, okay.
So it's still claimed all the way up and still has placer, you know, little mom and pop placer miners on it today. And so in those areas, yeah, you're going to find old cabins, and in some cases, cabins that are still in use. You'll also find if people were living there long enough, then someone passes away, they bury them in the backyard.
Right, right.
And so, yeah, we did re-find at least one of them, the Michelson Cemetery. And so you do find that, but those aren't areas where they were, you know, it's kind of like those are areas where the trail was actually a road.
Uh-huh.
Historic.
Right.
So they weren't putting anything new, but we were just documenting what was adjacent.
Right, right.
It's more of an FYI so that if they ever plan to put in any interpretive or campsites or something, they know where not to put it.
Right, right. Well, and I was just thinking, you know, when the Iditarod Trail was used originally, you know, people certainly probably died along the right way. And, you know, if that happened, you know, did you bury the person? I suppose in the winter you might have taken them with you on the sled and put them someplace else. I don't know. What would have happened to people?
Yeah, in the Southern Track, I mean, the railroad was in almost to Girdwood in 1906. And so they mushed on the railroad, on the tracks.
Okay.
And then they had various other forms that people aren't used to, meaning not only the hand pump carts that you could take, but they had what we call high rails today, which is cars that you can just drive on that have little wheels. And then,
yeah, like what the railroad workers use with their little trucks. Yeah.
But it used to be, and you can see pictures of people that had that.
Oh, okay.
And then the old, like before you could drive through the Whittier Tunnel, you used to drive onto the train on flatbeds. You did that in Seward to get to Moose Pass until like the 1930s.
Oh, okay.
And so you drove onto the flatbeds in Seward, and then they dropped you off in Moose Pass, and then you could start driving from there. So they didn't actually connect the Seward Highway to actually a good usable road until that was completed, I think, like, what, 1940? I
can't remember, but yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking that, say, in the original use of the trail as a transportation from Seward to Nome, mm-hmm. People certainly didn't make it all the way.
Yeah.
And what happened to those bodies that, you know.
Yeah, we knew, we did find one of the, pioneer cemeteries, and in where it was supposed to be.
Right.
But otherwise, you're kind of looking for depressions because the markers are usually not there.
Right.
There are some big differences. There is one of the sea captains, down at Sunrise does have a beautiful marker.
Okay.
Unfortunately, the original wood one isn't in the museum, but there is a replica, plus fraternal organizations put an actual marble marker. Other ones, like when we did the railroad alignment, we did know that there is a burial out there of one fatality that occurred. They actually didn't have that many fatalities. Wow. But we were unable to, we tried looking, based on the, because there is descriptions of what the workers did.
Uh-huh.
But we were not able to find.
Yeah, and I'm thinking about it too, as I ask about it, hope. The Community of Hope maybe had a cemetery that people got buried, in the community of Iditarod, these old places that now...
Well, and Hope had a Native community before the miners showed up.
Oh, okay.
And so we surveyed, but we did actually find Native homes.
Right.
Further away, and then we do know that there's probably burials.
Right.
That near the town, like within the town.
Yeah.
But we weren't there to survey the town because that's
right. It's a different thing. Okay, so once you started with the easement unit, mm-hmm. can you tell me about that?
So I was interviewed and then offered the position by Cliff Larson. He was the original manager of the unit, and. So I started, January 1st, 2nd, after the holiday of 2007, and I was the first employee. Cliff had started in the position in 2006, to establish it, how many would be there, and then to do the hiring. And then Ben Hagedorn was the other employee, and he came on, he was already an employee of the South Central Regional Land Office. And then he transferred to that position internally mid-January.
And how do you spell his last name, Ben?
H-A-G-E-D-O-R-N.
Okay.
Hagedorn.
So you said that the easement unit was established in 2006. Mm-hmm. What was its purpose? Why was it established?
It was established, so the state received a grant. It was applied for by the ITC, the Iditarod Trail Committee, which is the race committee. And then also they had seed money from the Iditarod Historic Trail Alliance. And I think the alliance money may have come in just slightly ahead, meaning they knew the grant was coming, but they gave some... a substantial amount of seed money themselves, And it was actually to do easements along, so the major owner, the land manager, along the trail is the state of Alaska. They have at least 75%, if not closer to 80%. It's, and so the grants, which was the ITC applied to Fed Highways for a grant to establish easements along the Iditarod Trail on state of Alaska land. Now they were trying, they were, from their point of view, not just doing, they were doing the race route basically. And then the money from the Alliance, which is the nonprofit for the Iditarod National Historic Trail, was to do the easements on segments of trail that the race wasn't on, but it was part of the Iditarod National Historic Trail.
Okay. So the race route is not exactly the same.
Yeah, so the race route doesn't, so the Iditarod National Historic Trail is like 2,300 miles total. You know, the race route is not that long. So there's segments of trails and communities that the historic route goes to that the race route does not.
Okay.
And some of it might be obvious. Like, let's say if you're going from Ophir to Iditarod, there's a summer route and a winter route. They're only on the winter route.
All right.
Because they're not.
and whereas the historic trail designation covers
has
both.
Both, yeah.
Right.
And so it's things like that. And then also, it can be multiple where they overlay, because the vast majority of the race route does overlay the Iditarod National Historic Trail. And then, you know, as part of it, it was a lot of research at the beginning of the project to figure out, are they overlaid? Are they separate? And do we have, I guess, unique circumstances, depending on the community? Because we did, you know, for example, we found out in looking at the INHT, there was an error that BLM made for Shaktulik. And for that one, BLM went off the USGS topo maps on where Shaktulik is. Well, Shaktulik has moved twice.
Oh.
And the one that they were using, which was correct for the INHT, but it didn't give an easement for the then race route to connect to the current village. So they had a hole.
Oh.
And so it was really looking at things like that, that there were a couple communities that actually had holes.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, there was a couple other errors in the mapping that BLM had done. One was going into McGrath, and then another one was near Elam.
Well, and BLM would have done that mapping in 86 for the Comprehensive Management Plan, or?
Yeah.
78 when it was designated?
It would have been 78 when they were doing the resource inventory for what became the Comprehensive Management Plan. So it started in, I think that one was like 78, 79.
Yeah.
A lot of the routes were, maps were finished by 81. And by maps, I mean 11 by 17 tabloid size with a felt tip marker, you know, taken from outer space. So it's not mapping like we would consider it today.
Right.
And so, yeah, the hand-drawn felt tip alignment sometime was not correct.
Right. Well, you say, yeah, the USGS at this big scale, and then on the ground it's different.
Well, and they were using, I think, the 250, the bigger scale, which is not what you want to do anyway. And then they shrunk that down to 11 by 17 and used a felt tip marker. And so the initial thing at the state was just to actually figure out where the trails are. And, you know, it's nice to have the digitized version of the plan, but it's not really helpful because it's so it's so bird's eye view, you know, not at a scale that's usable. So that once you zoom in, it's kind of like, well, it's somewhere in this mile. You know, and you're like, well, that doesn't really help me.
Yeah. And, well, you know, what we call the Iditarod Trail, as you say, it had all these different routes and it had lots of little side things in the original old days.
Yes and no, because, you know, once you're past the Alaska Range, it is one scar on the ground because they broke through the permafrost. And it has not changed. It is, you know, it was nice from Eastman's point of view because you can very clearly map where it is, and I don't need to go on the ground to figure out where it is because I can see it on Google Earth just fine. And GIS layers. But you do find that, especially north of the Alaska Range, that it hasn't moved. It is where it always was. And that's a lot of where it's co-located. Where really you're just looking at, are there places it was going to historically? It's not today.
Right. Well, that's what I was thinking, that historically it might have gone over to this community that's not there anymore, or, you know, they use trails from community to community that aren't used in.
Yeah, there's
I thought when I'm reading the comprehensive management plan that it sort of encompassed all those possible little things, not just the straight route.
No, it's not just what today is, like the race is on today.
Right.
It was what it was historically, as which it should be as a National Historic Trail. So like Dishkaket, which is a community within the Anoko National Wildlife Refuge today. And that was a major community, and it has a whole bunch of trails, and this is north and west of Iditarod. And there's like a spoke of trails going into it. Well, Dishkaket isn't there today.
Right.
I think Placerville is another one that's not there today. That was a big community.
Right.
But there's other communities like Flat, that Flat was still a town at statehood. So So it's new that it's not there. It still does have some placer mining, so people are there in the summer. But it's very recent a ghost town. And so that is truly walking into a standing building town that just doesn't have people. And it looks like they just walked away one day. Versus like Iditarod, which is also a ghost town, but more in the past.
Yeah.
You know, that was more like by 1930 that it was, you know, in the 30s versus the 60s, 70s.
So you said that the state is the largest landowner along the trail. I thought BLM was the...
They're the smallest.
But they were given the management authority.
You know, I think Judy Benner could probably talk about that, but what I've been told is that at the time, you know, in 78 and definitely when they were working on the, you know, when this was designated, that was also at the time Anoka and other things were occurring. And so at the time, because usually it's the Park Service or the Forest Service that are given National Historic Trails, and they have full-on programs for those. But I was told the climate at the time is why BLM was picked over the Forest Service, or the Park Service, which do have nationally. And so the Iditarod is the only trail nationally that the BLM is the sole administrator of. And so they have no real program to help them. But yes, it's the state of Alaska is by far the largest landowner. And then I think for feds, it's the Fish and Wildlife Service that is the largest, than the Forest Service, then BLM. And I think BLM only has 100 miles.
So the state easement unit was set up specifically for the Iditarod Trail? Or they had other duties for other places around the state?
No, we did the Iditarod Trail, but in a broad sense. So it was the race route, the National Historic Trail, and almost any other trail called the Iditarod. And so we did the easements, but we also did permitting and leasing and project reviews along it. And this could be anything that makes sense, like safety cabins, which are meant for trail users, but it could also be other projects that just happen to be along it, or other trails, like, you know, we have like the Iron Dog Trail that is by itself for a while before it gets to the Iditarod.
Oh, okay.
And so we did adjudicate that one as well. And so other trails that I think people will call the Iditarod, but they're not. We did also adjudicate those because there was a legitimate reason that people were using them.
Right.
And they needed an easement themselves.
Right. That's interesting. I thought the Iron Dog went all on the same Iditarod trail route.
No, it because it leaves from Big Lake.
Oh, versus from Kinnick?
Yeah. So the, you know, the race originally left from Kinnick on the National Historic Trail on the historic alignment. But now it leaves out of Willow. And so we also did the Willow route to see if there were any parts of the route that they used down there that needed easements versus parts that are just on the river, where you don't necessarily, you don't need an easement to be on the river. And then we also did that for the Iron Dog because they leave out of Big Lake. They're okay. Not. And people use their route also, like snow machines use it as access to the rivers.
Okay.
And we do find that in the Matsu Borough, people self-separate, meaning the trails that people are pulling freight on are not the ones that people are racing, you know, the racing, you know, snow machines on, which might not be the same that the families are using or dog teams are using.
Or skiers or bikers are using. Oh, interesting. Well, then originally, you know, the Iditarod race started in downtown Anchorage. I mean, it still does now, but it's ceremonial. It used to actually be the
Used to go over the bridge, the Kinnick Bridge.
Yeah, and so there's a section of route that probably had to be permitted and easement and all that.
Well, that would have been on the, because I think they went down the highway.
I don't know where they went after they went down the C Street, hill.
They were just adjacent to the Glen Highway.
Oh, okay.
And then they went over the bridge. Because I think they tried one year to go under, like, and that's not, since the 64 earthquake, you can't do that. They could before it, but it's not safe now.
Yeah. Yeah, because I don't know how they connected, where, you know, from down to Anchorage, you know, on the Campbell Track, however they went. I don't know how they went from downtown Anchorage to get...
Oh, no, they just went up the Glen. So they went, like, to Eagle River.
Okay.
And then they went down the Glen and over the Kinnick Bridge. And then they would, and I can't remember which trail they went into, but that's how they...
So there's some kind of a trail out in the Palmer Flats out there someplace?
Yeah, they went across the flats, which is, there always was a trail there.
Right.
I think they went past Cottonwood, and then they came up Kinnick.
Okay. Headed west.
But that was only for a couple years. And then they did the ceremonial, and the ceremonial ended at Eagle River. So they still went out to Eagle River.
Okay.
And then that's where, and that was still going in the 90s. And then the going to Campbell Track is newer.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. There were some times that they would stop it at Mulcahy.
Right.
A very short.
because the snow conditions. Mm-hmm. But yeah. So I know the question about how the easement unit kind of got going and the lobbying for that, that's a little more maybe a Jim Palin question, but what do you know about that history since you were the first employee?
I don't know a lot about the 2006 lobbying. I do know that they applied to the Fed Highways for a trail grant. It was a pretty substantial trail grant, like it was... 500,000. I think it may have been 250,000 for the first round. But for that time, that was considered a large amount. And then in 2009, when we had the economic downturn and Obama had the a push for additional funds for employment, the Fed Highways actually got more money, and they reached out to awardees that were actually, I wouldn't say doing good work, but actually fulfilling their grants.
Mm-hmm.
And some, you know, because we had to do quarterly reports and, you know, and we did all of those and detailed everything that we were doing to them under their grant versus the other grant. And then we were awarded like a $500,000 on top of that from Fed Highways to keep the program going, or additional funding.
Right.
And then eventually the positions were funded by the state, but that only lasted 1 year.
Yeah, because I was wondering, to have a whole unit established just to adjudicate easements on a trail, like, how do you sell that? How is that?
Well, the
seemed important.
Well, the state's length of the trail exceeds 1,000 miles, and that's not normal for trails, even in Alaska. And it actually helped greatly, because you could, instead of having things broken up by regions, because in the state you have the south central region, you have the northern region, and so technically before there was a central place, things were being managed by two separate entities or groups.
Mm-hmm.
Having it centrally actually helped a lot, because it was like one-stop management approach to the entire system.
Okay.
But it was a lot of state land it covered. And it also helped with, I think, problems, especially growing problems in the Matsu Borough. We did spend a lot of time doing dealing with landowners and blockages and education of, you know, oh, by the way, this trail that you want to block was legal in, you know, 1916, and it surveyed across your property in 1916. you needed it. So we did a lot. You spent a lot of that, and that if we weren't there, another state employee would have to do it. So it's not like the work wouldn't be there.
Okay.
To me, it was just consolidated so that you had the same people going out, so that there was consistency.
And yeah, I mean, so what's the purpose of doing that and getting those easements? I mean, what does that do for the trail? I mean, the trail's there.
It's there, but if it doesn't have like a public access easement, then you run the risk of, if the state sells the land or issues a lease, it misses or doesn't protect it.
Okay.
And that is actually, and it's also, I think, in the management plan for the trail, was that to try to get easements along it or some sort of protection.
Okay.
And to do that on every, not just the state, but also on federal land. That is just disproportionate state land.
Right. But that, yeah, so that's the question. Like, what does an easement do for protecting a trail?
Yeah, so if it's in this case, we did public access easements, and we did what are called negative easements, which are easements that we could actually define what you can do within the easements without needing another authorization.
Okay.
And then things that you do need to apply if you want to do. And so we could say, yes, we're establishing this easement for this purposes. Here are the things automatically allowed within them, which are, if it's recreation based, if it's, you know, if you want to put up a recreation cabin, that's not prohibited. You do have to apply to do that. But it's, you know, you don't need a separate review to figure out, can you actually do that in this corridor?
And so you just get a recreational cabin or recreational use was one of those allowed. What are some other examples or examples of not allowed?
I don't know that we said things that were prohibited. It was more like you're saying things that, what you can do. And that allows the state to fast track, you know, and more easily approve.
So what were some of the allowed uses?
Well, obviously recreation-based. I know a lot of these routes are also the intervillage travel corridor, and so things related to that would also be allowed within that, because that's the reason it's there. Mm-hmm. You know, even in the Matsu Burrow, some of the alignments are still there to give access to the inholdings and people mm-hmm. that live there, that live in the communities. And then definitely after the Alaska Range, it is still being used today like it was 100 years ago. And in some cases, 1,000 years ago, depending on, because some of the alignments were the native routes between right. the villages. And so the route between, like, you know, Kaltag and Unalakleet has been there for a lot longer than the Iditarod Trail right. has right. been there.
Right. And so that gives, if people want to brush out the trail and keep it clear, that's an allowed use.
That's an allowed use.
They don't have to get extra permission.
No. But if you wanted to do something above what is the allowed use, then you do. And there's a difference between allowed use and what's called a change in use. Meaning, if you have a trail, and this is just general easement-wide in the state, it doesn't mean that you can just go and decide to build a road yourself in it. Because that's called a change in use.
Right.
Because it wasn't designed to have highway vehicles on it. And so that's a completely separate process and a separate public, you know,
right.
forum to actually do that.
But if you wanted to now ride bicycles on the trail,
that's fine.
That's okay.
But, yeah.
And then what about, you bringing up roads makes me think of the 2477.
Yeah, a lot of them are also RS-2477s. And so a lot of times you'll see the Iditarod easement will be 400 feet wide. That is actually done on purpose. And that's because within that 400 feet, you're going to have also stacked rights, meaning it might have what's called an RS-2477, which is 100 feet fixed width. And you do the 400 to allow that maybe in the future this 100 foot gets developed into something that doesn't allow for hikers, bikers, snow machines, you know, all the use that currently is there. And we need to move it over, and this would allow for the buffer.
Oh, okay.
So that so that's what you were describing. What can occur? So thinking into the future of what can happen, that would then allow you, give you enough room to allow it to continue as a trail. And Alaska is unique in that it classifies in, you know, statute, right? A trail is a highway. So it's perfectly fine to have a trail and that be, in effect, the intervillage travel corridor, uh-huh. that is still a legitimate transportation route. It's not a vehicle highway route, but it is a highway.
That's confusing. Yeah. Okay, that's very confusing. You said you had to do a lot of research on the route mm-hmm. beforehand.
Yeah, we had to do a lot of research to figure what already had easements.
Were there any easements existing?
Okay. Yeah. So there's a, from one of the big ones is, on state land is from Connect to Susit, Connect to Rainy Pass. Mm-hmm. But it's surveyed to, I want to say One Finger Lake, but I think I'm wrong on the lake name. But it has a good amount heading to Squintna already surveyed. So they did that in the 80s. I think it was like 88 was when it was finalized. And so that one, it's that's the highest grade you can have. So it's not in doubt where it is.
Right.
That was surveyed. And so that did have, and so we weren't looking at that segment because that's already finished, and that was done for the Iditarod National Historic Trail. So that was a negative easement for the INHT.
Okay.
The historic route is an RS-2477 underlying that.
Oh, okay.
And so that was all, which was all explained in the survey documents.
Okay. And so where did you guys start?
We started, if there were areas on, well, we started from Seward and went to Nome. And so we divided it initially as, so Ben Hagedorn did Seward to McGrath. and then I did McGrath to Nome.
Okay.
And that's how we divided it. And it, and McGrath is not the middle. It, that was done more because there's more private property between Seward and McGrath.
Okay.
So it gave him more little tiny segments. And so in our dual thing of what we were doing, you know, we were doing easements for the race route, but we were also doing it for the Iditarod National Historic Trail. And those, for private property, there might be an easement, an RS-2477, or a small recreation easement that, you know, maybe is 50 feet wide or less for the actual trail today. But that's not actually, let's say, a negative or a conservation easement that the National Historic Trail was looking for, meaning having anything like a buffer or defining what can happen in it, you know. And so for those private parcels that had the access easement but not the negative easement, we would actually reach out and ask if they were, you know, interested. Occasionally you would find a parcel, it wasn't very common, that had nothing. And then those you were, so in the state of Alaska, you can, DNR has a pre-approved form that you can designate an easement, an access easement for a trail, as long as it's 50 feet or less, for free. I mean, there's a form, you just fill it out and you, it's free to record. You don't even have to pay the recording fees. And so we would send those to those landowners to see, could you do that? But it just depended, because it took a lot of research to figure out, because it's not that common that there's nothing.
Right.
There usually is. It's more, is it something that doesn't protect a trail? Meaning it just depended on what it was, because we do actually have a lot of parcels, especially from McGrath to Nome, that are patented mine claims instead of homesteads. And the bundle of rights that comes with those is very different. A lot of the patented mine claims would have had surveys, and so the trail actually may have been surveyed. So we could actually point out, no, and the fact that they're there, that would be the RS-2477, because that's a trail specifically established for access to mining areas.
Yeah.
And a lot of it was just reaching out to, you know, I think we kind of knew that the miners would probably not want to put a negative easement on their parcel, but a lot of it was education. And frankly, the miners, once you said, no, this is what's in your survey, they knew what that meant. Meaning they're actually used to dealing with the old trails and what they're required to do, as far as it's okay for them to mine, but they have to move it and have connected access while they're doing that, and then they have to put it back.
Oh, okay.
And they're used to doing that, and what the requirements are for doing that, for routes that have legal routes. And we're actually true RS-2477s.
Yeah, I didn't thought about that for mining, they would disturb the ground and then destroy the trail.
And their claim, what they have to submit either to the state or the feds, and they're used to doing this, especially on the old claims, they will move it outside of the work area, but they know it has to be of the standard that it was before. So people still need to be able to safely go around.
Right.
And then when they're done mining that area, they just put it back where it was.
Yeah. And move on. Oh, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a difference between the private lands along the trail that the trail went through and the state lands that it went through.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you deal with those differently?
Well, a lot of the places where there's private land, a lot of time, except for, you know, like the patented mine claims, those typically were patented 100 years ago, if not more.
Right.
That's different than, let's say, we're talking about things that were patented in the 60s and 70s. Because those, without a doubt, have an RS-2477 on them. It doesn't really take a lot of research. And so those are well known. Those are surveyed areas a lot of times. A lot of it is more homeowner education. Because unfortunately, an RS-2477 right away is not required to be in a title document. And so you can have somebody who just moves up here, sees their deed, and it doesn't mention a trail anywhere.
Okay.
And they don't know, oh yeah, by the way, this has a 100-foot right away going through the middle of your parcel, and no, you can't block it, you can't move it. I mean, there's ways to legally move it, but please, you know, come to DNR and ask.
Right.
You know, don't just do something first and ask later. And so it's a lot of education of private landowners, only because it's just not, those types of easements are not required to be in deeds in Alaska.
And so what was your success with those, with private landowners, or lack of success?
We only had one major lack of success that went to court.
Tell me about that one.
Well, that was Dixon v. State. So that were the children of a homesteader off of Burma Road, or on Burma Road, in the Matsu Borough, that blocked initially the their father blocked the RS-2477. And people then moved to a homestead road as the alternate access, meaning it connected with the Iditarod and reconnected right after their land. And so people just started doing that. And then they went and blocked that route. I believe it was like 2011. And we did our, you know, education of, oh, by the way, there's, you know, there's these legal routes. And that one actually went to court, and the state won that, yes, there's an RS-2477. And it's actually a very, really good final finding and judgment to read, the long version, not the just the judgment. Mm-hmm. Because the judge did explain all the easements, meaning what's an easement for the INHT, which is a negative easement, versus the RS-2477, versus, in this case, a homestead road. And so in that one, it was the RS-2477 from Kinnick to Susitna was affirmed. And yeah, and that it's continuous and it's where it's always been.
And even though it crosses your private land, you
your private land was well after it was ever established and it was well known.
Okay. I guess we should explain what RS-2477 is. Keep throwing out there.
Yeah. So an RS-2477 is a route established on federal land, on unencumbered federal land, for access to mining areas. And so as long as the land was federal, and it didn't matter, it didn't need to be, let's say, the feds or the territory doing the construction or work on the trail, the locals could do it. But it's just as long as that's the reason was for access to mining areas.
Oh, okay.
You had a legal right, and then your route was protected. And then in, I want to say it was like 1954, the widths were standardized, where BLM came out and said, okay, if you have this, it's 100 feet wide. For the litigation, this area wasn't staked and became private until after that standardization.
Okay.
And so for the route that was for access to the mining areas, and was the old mail route, inner route, worked on by the Alaska Road Commission.
Right.
That one was established at 100 feet, whereas the homestead road, and the homesteader who built it was still alive, that one was a prescriptive easement. And that one, I think, was only like 20 feet wide. It was like from ditch to ditch.
Uh-huh. What's a prescriptive easement?
That's an easement for... in this case, we had a homesteader who put in a road to his, not only his homestead, but it serviced all the homesteads in the area from off of Burma Road. Mm-hmm. And went back, it went all the way back to his, which was pretty far back, but it accessed everybody else.
Right.
Well, he never went and got like an easement for it or proclaimed anything. Well, as things become private, if somebody has like a road or a trail, and it's been used for decades across your parcel, I think it depends on if it's considered adverse or you agreed to it.
Uh-huh.
what year it, and whether it's like 7 years or 9 years you need to show use, at that point is considered legal.
Okay.
That you have granted the access because you're, everybody's using it and you said nothing.
Right.
And so that's what the judge said for the road, was that it was legal access because it accessed all these homesteads, including your own. It was the original access to that homestead.
Right.
And how you got back to town.
Right. Sort of like grandfathered in. You've been there, you've been using it long enough that...
Yeah.
Yeah. I hadn't realized that RS-247 was specifically related to mining access.
Yep.
But if you said it was on unencumbered federal land, what about, you know, we were a territory. I guess that was considered federal land?
Yep.
Okay.
It was when the U.S. bought Alaska, if it wasn't, you know, owned or private, then it's unencumbered federal land.
Okay.
Now, it could have quickly been encumbered, meaning a good one would be if it was military land. But in, there's not that many encumbered at that point in time.
Right. And then when we became a state, it became... The state selected land, and those parcels became state land.
Yeah.
Right. But if there had been a route...
But if there was a pre-existing route, in this case, the, like, Kinnick-to-Susitna Trail, this was an official route that was the mail route.
Right.
And it was maintained by the Alaska Road Commission. You know, this was a lot easier to document versus other RS-2477s.
Yeah.
Because it does have quite a paper trail. For other ones, let's say, where you do have, let's say, neighbors arguing about a trail, then, you know, you would have to go back and figure out where in time can we find this and can we find documentation as to why it's there. And that would differentiate between whether you have an RS-2477 or just a prescriptive easement.
Uh-huh. And then on, parcels that were owned by the state, how did you get that easement put in? You just went to DNR and said, we want to put this trail easement in?
No, once the funds were there and we were there, you know, we broke it into segments where we would do, you know, because we didn't need to do anything from Kinnick to, you know, Susitna. And then partially beyond that, but once you get to Susitna, there's a fork because there's the main route and then there's connecting routes.
Right.
And so we needed to look at the connecting routes to see if any needed easements. And so we did have some areas that needed them around Squintna, mainly just to get off the river safely. Right. And this is somewhat might be small ones. And at the same time, we were also looking at what is the current use pattern. And does it make sense to also designate areas to help protect how people are using it today? Which is, we do have a lot of self-separation. And we did find a lot of the Iditarod Trail that's not on the river tended to be where you had slower moving people, like people pulling freight. You did have dog teams. But then we also needed to look at, are there other trails that don't have easements that have, let's say, the faster moving people on them, that if the state doesn't recognize them, in the future they might end up on the one that does have a route where it's not constructed and has never been maintained to separate people, meaning they're all on one trail.
Right.
And so we did other, like near Shell Lake, we did some access points to get people like legally in and off that lake, and what the state can do. In some places, it was also dealing with the state would put subdivision or rec staking areas in. And sometimes, especially in the past, that would be done without actually getting the legal access to the staking area. And so we were doing that, meaning as we're going along the trail, okay, people are going here and then veering off. Well, does the veer off to get to the subdivision have legal access?
Right.
And so we would do that to connect. So it was a you know, bigger than just plain the Iditarod. We were also looking at what connects to it.
Uh-huh.
And what are people self-separating, and does that need legal protection itself? We didn't do all of them, but we did do the major ones.
Uh-huh. And so, yeah, I guess my question is, what does that mean, putting in an easement and protection easement on state property? You have to get it on a map, on a survey?
Yeah, so we have, well, first we have to do public notice. So we still had to do the state online public notice, do an agency review to get comments in. You know, we just can't, even though it's state land, we just can't go and do it.
Okay.
We still do have a public review process. And then following that, you know, you have to write up a decision. And for an easement, a lot of times it can be a two-step process, meaning, you know, if somebody applies to the state, you know, you do the whole agency review, public notice, you write a decision, and then they might have an authorization that allows them to go and do something, and that might just be to do the survey.
Right.
Depending on what they're applying for. If it's an existing trail that needs no work, it might just be, okay, we need you to go out and serve, you know, let us know exactly where this is. And so it's a two-step process before they actually get their easement. So they'll get an authorization allowing them to either manage it or do whatever work is needed to, you know, in effect, get their final easement. For a public easement, those are held by the state of Alaska. And so what will happen is an authorization might be given to a trail club to actually work on it and manage it. But the actual easement, because it's public,
right,
will actually be held by the state.
Right.
And for us, since we were dealing with such large areas, we did have meetings with the survey group and, you know, the regional manager and higher ups as to what is required for the state to do this themselves, because we don't have funding to send our surveyors out and survey a route all the way to Nome. It would probably take a decade. And so we found what would be the minimum, you know, what are the standards needed for us to do that? And so we did come up with like a policy, and then also what do we do? Because if we have a 400-foot state easement, and you're heading, let's say, towards McGrath, well, you're going to have native parcels, like small parcels along right. the way, or a homestead, where you don't necessarily want a 400-foot wide easement heading into it, because that's literally from one property boundary to the other with no guidance to the public that, no, we mean stay on the trail.
Right.
And so we had a policy that before we get to the small property like that, we would actually neck down the easement to the width that it is on the parcel. And if that's 100 feet, it'd be 100 feet. If it's 25, it'd be 25. And we would base that on something that people could see. Now, if it had been surveyed, we have a survey monument, we might anchor it to the survey monument. But otherwise, it might be if there's a creek crossing, you know, 50 feet before that, we'll do it at there and make it the width that it is crossing the private, and then it opens back up
once it's back on public land.
Yeah. And at that point in time, the regional manager would call that the good neighbor policy, so that we're not creating headaches to the private property owner.
Makes sense.
Yeah. But no, it went through the full public process and agency review that's required even if a private person wants to apply.
Right.
And then we had to make maps that would go with the easement documents to show people where it is. And we did have to anchor it to something. And then we would have, you know, points along the way, like GPS points to point people as to where this alignment is located, so that they know where the center of the 400 feet is being anchored.
You mentioned survey markers, and obviously you said, you know, the whole trail hasn't been surveyed, so if you didn't have a survey marker to anchor it to, What would you anchor to? A GPS point?
Yeah, so one of the things we did the first winter, we used MapGrade GPS and went to the end of the survey. That was done in the 80s.
Right.
And continued on the trail. And then we also did the public use trail to see if there's a difference. And so we did that by, you know, MapGrade, so that, because we were required to do MapGrade mapping, so that we didn't need an easement, which is not a recreation grade GPS.
It's a higher grade?
It's a higher grade. So it's in between survey grade and recreation that we can all use is what's called MapGrade. Uh-huh. And that was our requirement, is that we had to have MapGrade or something else to anchor it to. Now, when you do get to like native allotments, those do have surveys and have monuments you can anchor, BLM okay. monuments. So those we could find. And sometimes you could also find them if there's a big property boundary. It just depended on where you were and if you were lucky. Uh-huh. But otherwise, so we did the survey grade, map grade, sorry, up to Pentilla Lake. And then we had another entity carry it beyond there. And then we also had ITC do some of like, can somebody take this along the route? You know, when your trail breakers go through, can they, you know, do this type of GPS thing all the way to Nome? And so they did for both the north and the south route.
Okay.
So that was, you know, pretty easy for the race route. And then in some areas, we would then also use aerial mapping. You know, depending on where you were and what you had to do, it does luck out that the parts of the trail that you needed to use aerial mapping are ones where it's one big scar on the ground
right.
and hasn't moved. So it wasn't really a question there. It was more when you do it, can you anchor the beginning and end and describe it correctly? And so in that, you might be using like ArcGIS to, or CAD, AutoCAD, to tell you what these points are and give you the coordinates.
So did you go out in the field and ground truth these sections?
Yeah, so we did the out in the field between Seward and Pentilla Lake, which is Rainy Pass. That was easy, and then we then went, we teamed up with BLM to do some summer helicopter work for a couple seasons, and that was based out of McGrath. And then we also, because we knew when we had the easements, like going into Iditarod, or areas where we actually did have standing safety cabins, that we needed to be on the ground to actually do true GPS points and actually point out where all these structures are located. And so we did that the first summer and the second summer. And then after that, the state would go out occasionally and do that. And then we did get a state grant to also do work on Don's, what's called, people call Don's Cabin, which is Alaska Road Commission cabin, in between Ophir and Iditarod. And it's still standing. And since it was a state structure, we received a small, I think it was like $40,000 grant to do the repairs to bring it up, you know, fix the issues at the cabin. And then I also went, let's see, I went to Nome also for a couple times and did presentations in Nome. You know, Nome, like Nome to Solomon is the highway. It's a trail in the winter because they don't plow to Solomon.
Right.
But it is actually a highway, so we didn't need to like survey that. It's
right.
And a lot of it was also doing that type, okay, where do we have surveys? Where are we actually on a road, even though it's seasonal? And then also, you know, when it's like on the Yukon or the Kuskokwim, those can also be highways themselves in the winter, meaning like the Yukon is actually signed by DOT.
Oh, okay.
And so just, and there we were just mainly figuring out where the anchors are to get on and off the river.
Yeah, I was going to say a trail on the river.
It's from bank to bank.
Yeah, but it goes away in the summertime. I mean, I guess it's a trail when you're using a boat, but, mm-hmm. you know, you don't really do a trail easement on the river, do you?
No, we point out where, because it's navigable, especially if it's like the Yukon or the Kuskokwim, it's navigable, so it's state water.
Right.
Like, we don't need an easement on it. You just need to anchor where the trail is going in and out of it.
Okay.
And because that's where the easement is. You might show it, like on the map, show right. it, but in another color going down the right. river. So that it doesn't make it look like you're putting holes, you know, to a layperson looking at it. But you're not putting an easement on the river.
Right.
Because the river itself is navigable.
And so, yeah, so to make an easement on, a trail easement on state land, you did all this process and then you get it officially mapped as an easement.
Mm-hmm. And then we record the actual easement with the maps.
Okay. And was there, opposition to any of this? As you said, you had to go through this whole review process. So for this is right now just the state lands. We'll get to the private ones next. Yeah. But
the state land, the only opposition at the beginning came from BLM, and that was that they wanted the width to be 1,000 feet instead of 400. And we picked, the state picked 400 because that matched the existing easement. So for the survey from out of Kinnick right. is 400 feet wide, that easement for right away. And so we didn't want to have a whole bunch of different widths. The state didn't. We wanted something consistent that people could expect, meaning we weren't surprising them that it was just going wide and then, you know,
right.
all these random widths. But we did have to, you know, like write some white papers to give to BLM to explain what a state easement is and why the management plan for the ones the feds have to use don't have 1,000 feet along the whole length of it. It's only in certain parts, and there's some that are as small as 25 feet. And we had segments that were high use that had this narrow 25 or 100 feet in the plan, where the state's like, no, because we can't, we know they're using more than 25 right now. We're not going to follow the plan. We're picking the standard route. We were going down routes that are being used. So it's not a question of, are there not people using it? and so we just kept that standard width. I think there was only one area that I think we did 100 feet. And that would have been one of the summer route that's, you know, hunters might use in the communities, but they're not really high recreation. But the routes are still there.
Right.
And easily fall, you know, you can hike them yourself, but they're just not in areas that have a lot of people.
And so you were able to convince BLM of the 400 foot.
Yes.
They gave in.
Yes. Once we explained that, you know, well, by the way, and I think what it came down to was after, you know, Puntilla Lake or Rainy Pass for folks that are used to that, you know, you go into Roan, and then once you're at Roan, there's a south route and a north route up the, and so the race route goes up the north branch.
Uh-huh.
The south branch around what's called Shell Hills, or not Shell Hills, but the mountain that's there has state recreation staking areas, and so that it's used because right. people need to get to their claim, their cabin areas.
Right.
And if we went off the plan, it should only be 25 feet wide, and we're like, well, that's the snow machine route. That's like, it's, you know, even in our area plans, we can't do something that narrow for things that have snow, you know, the snow machines need to pass each other.
Right.
And so we explained it that way, that no, we have, you know, it's nice to use the comprehensive management plan, but it is a plan frozen in time. And they were doing widths based on what the use was in 1970s something.
Right.
And They may have made an error at the time or not asked, is this route being used? But we know that we do have ones that got coded as minimum management 25 feet that have today are major routes. And then we have others that are 1,000 feet that are going to abandoned places.
Right.
And so we picked, you know, we had discussions at the state and we just said, you know what, we have this 400 foot easement already, right away already existing. Let's just keep that so that we're not confusing the people.
Right.
And so that's what the state did, was that it'd be 400 feet. There is an area around Ophir where it is 100 along the, but that was also another complaint from, I think, the feds.
And was there public complaint when
no.
you well, did public notice on those state easements?
No. I think, you know, I think a couple people asked, why is it this? And then we could respond. You know, you'd answer back, oh, it's just matching. And nobody ever followed back up to complain about that once it was explained why it was that width.
Well, obviously, none of those. Was there any public opposition to doing a trail easement to protect the Iditarod Trail?
No. And I think there was actually a lot of surprise. I think we got a lot of inquiries like, you mean this isn't protected? I think a lot of people thought it already was.
Yeah.
And then, you know, once you're off the road system, which is pretty quick on a 2,300 mile trail system, that's their highway.
Right.
And so they're, yeah, that's what they want it protected, because that's their intervillage travel corridor. So they're, at the same time, they also did the same. You mean we didn't have an easement?
Right. Well, that's what I was thinking. People who use these trails all the time, we just assume.
Yeah.
I don't even think we assume it's protected. It's a trail. That's what we do. We use it. You don't even think about if it's legally protected somehow.
Yeah. No, and especially in the villages, like, well, we've been using this over 1,000 years. What do you mean it's not protected?
Yeah.
Like, what do you mean we need an easement?
Right. And I'd say, what are the with, like, why do we need an easement? We've been using it for 100 years, so why do we?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in those, it's more of a legal protection so that you don't have to go to court to prove to a judge that it was here for 100 years. And that it's, yeah, it's really this route and not the one over there and the one over there.
Well, and as you say, if for some reason somebody wanted to come and do some development or something else on that land,
it's not within a state system being tracked. If it doesn't have an actual, like, ADL number,
right,
an actual easement number, it's people, like, within the state system, if somebody applies to whatever permitting or the state has its own project, they're going to look in there and then they're going to say, okay, here's everything that's here and what the rights are. And if you're not in that list.
Right. Even if you've been using the trail for hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that you don't have a legal right. It means that you might have to go to a court to proclaim your rights.
Right. Interesting.
And defend your rights.
Right. So now we get to the question of where it crossed private lands or native allotments or, you know, maybe native corporation lands. All of that is different issues than when you had to do the state lands.
Yeah, so when we're doing, like, an easement for the INHT, which is a negative easement, meaning we're saying some things that can happen. Like, if you're actually setting conditions for an easement, that's called a negative easement, versus just a plain, okay, it's public recreation, it's this wide, and it's silent about everything. Those, a lot of times, so when you get a native allotment, there will be what's called a 17B easement, which is, depending on, or another acronym easement, depending on if it's ANCSA or ANILCA it's under. So we would be anchoring to that easement, meaning whatever easement number it is, it'll have a number that BLM or BIA gave it. So they're required to go in, because that is the access for the allottee to get to their allotment. And I think probably the allottees didn't know is that, you know, BLM or BIA, you know, would have put the 25 to 50 foot easement on what's now the INHT across their parcel, but it didn't go and see, is there an actual easement for you to get to that parcel? And that's what we were doing. And we did get some inquiries on, like, from the native corporations, but as long as we were, like, necking it down so it matched when it got to their land, what the width is on their land that they're subject to, then we didn't really get complaints. Because you're not creating a management nightmare for them.
So they were accepting of a trail easement going through their allotment?
Well, or that would have
corporation?
Been... Yeah, well, that would have been done by BLM. So that would have... So when the native corporations, like, selected the land, BLM would have gone out, and you'll see it in the title... the title documents. They'll have subject to and list all the easements. And it's usually 25 or 50 feet, depending on what type of use it was. And so for the vast majority, they already know what these are. All they want is that when our easement matches theirs at the property line, it's the same width.
So, what, like, so example, when the corporation selected their land, and the Iditarod Historic Trail went across it, they already knew that that was there as an easement?
No. So what would have been, so they would have selected their land. BLM is supposed to then go out and figure out what routes cross it, what routes are the public using.
Right.
And then would have had what are called 17B easements, which are the actual travel corridors identified. And so they, you know, will have the interim conveyance or the conveyance document, and it'll have this whole list of here's all the trails or site easements or whatever else they're designating. And hopefully BLM did all that every once in a while. And same with the state, you would find a title document that's completely silent and says nothing. And then that would be a negotiation of, okay, we know this is the intervillage travel corridor. They're not going to block it.
Right.
You know, because their own constituents need to get between the villages. Right. And so we found, let's say, between McGrath and Nikolai, it alternates by section ownership, meaning it's like state, native, state, native, state, native. Every mile, it changes, flips back and forth. And in that one, it was like a coin toss whether BLM put it in there for the state or the native corporation. And so in that case, I believe it was like Doyon and MTNT, we had to sit down and say, okay, they messed it up for all of us. We know Nikolai needs to get to McGrath, and McGrath needs to get to Nikolai. So that's not a question. So what are we going to do? And are you okay with that? So yeah, we would talk with them. And if they had questions, we always answered them.
And were those negotiations successful? They were like, yeah, that's okay.
Yeah, because the most part, once you're above the Alaska Range, you're on an intervillage travel corridor.
Right.
So it's, you know, I think for them, it doesn't look good to say, no, we're going to say no to an easement for your ability to go from village to village.
Right.
It was more of a, I think, annoyance for all of us, because depending on how the feds... BLM for routes can do two things. They can either make you subject to it, meaning you're the landowner, but you're subject to this easement or right-of-way, or they can do what's called accepted and reserved, meaning they have carved out, however wide it is, the right-of-way and reserve that to the federal government for management. If you are either the state or the native corporation, and that has happened, you get credit for that acreage, and you get to select
other acreage.
And depending on where you were, if you had one of those weird mishmashes, it's going to depend on whether the state or the native corporation is happy that they got either subject to this or it was carved out.
Uh-huh.
You know, some you know, sometimes even the state doesn't want the carve out because they want to be the manager. They don't want to have a random 1 mile.
Right.
Where if they have to go work on it, or and same with a native corporation, they have to actually go to say, BLM, we need you to go and actually do some trail work.
Versus if it's the subject to...
Subject to, then the two, the state and the native corporation can work just together and not have to bring BLM in for some like tiny little...
So what was it? Why would BLM do it one way versus the other?
A lot of those were done before any of us were there. Some of them can be in, you know, title documents from the 60s, like right after statehood. And you're not sure, like, okay, why is this couple miles this way and this couple miles over here this way? And you would also see that on Forest Service grants, where the state would be subject to, or they would give what's called an ANILCA concurrence on a route, meaning like, yeah, when this comes, we all agree. This is the Iditarod Trail, and we're not going to be arguing about it. And then the next title document would accept and reserve a trail.
Huh.
And then the next title document would be something else entirely, where it's like you're subject to the National Trails Act, but there's no agreements, and everybody's like, so where do we think this is?
Yeah, wow, it's complicated.
Yeah. And so that's why we did a lot of research. But yeah, there were problem areas, and there were a lot of, you know, unfortunate problem areas, I don't want to say caused by BLM, but things where the state and the Native Corporation or Iñárritu were dealing with the same problem that none of them caused. And so it's kind of like everybody was in the same boat.
Uh-huh. Well, that's good. It created some cooperation.
Yeah.
With the state and the Native corporations, maybe.
Yeah, so we did have some areas where it's kind of like, well, okay, what do we all agree we're going to do from point A to point B? Because we all know, yeah, people are going to be using it. We need to manage it. What do we agree? Because our title documents are either don't say anything or they're confusing.
Because
mm-hmm. Occasionally you would find that BLM would put the wrong wording in or the wrong segment. Or
and would if it was confusing or... it wasn't in the title document, would you then go in and fix it so that it's now there, or you just leave them confusing?
It depended. At that time, a lot of it, I think it was, if we can come, like, if the current landowners, land managers, can come together and come to a realization, then we don't even need to tell BLM. And that was quicker. And, you know, the climate at the time was... for not only the state, but the Native corporations, where it's like, okay, we're waiting 45 years for a title document.
Right.
If we point out this in our interim, or interim conveyance or tentative approval, depending on which entity, is that going to set us back 20 more years? Or do we just have the two entities that are managing it do an agreement and say, okay, we're going to have this with, you're going to have that with, we're all going to meet up here. And can I have a letter of authorization or a letter of non-rejection that we all agree?
Right. So, yes, so you would make sure the new agreements were in writing and in the record, mm-hmm. even if you...
if it was needed.
Right. You don't go back and correct it. You just update, kind of.
Yeah. I only know of one that had to go... it was so bad it had to go back.
And what was that one?
I think that was one... it was, like, near Rhone. And it was one of those where... they had the wrong names of the segments.
Oh, yeah.
And the wrong widths. So not only did they have the wrong names, but the widths didn't match the management plan for even the trail there, plus the one they named. And so you couldn't really do the, what would a judge do? Meaning, if a judge looked at it, would they say they have now clouded the title versus, okay, this is a typo. We all know what they mean.
Right.
Okay, they named the segment that just ended. We all know they meant this. And it's all in, you know, the selection documentation that it really meant, you know, right. You were talking about this trail. And I only know of one that was so bad that, I mean, it had segments that weren't, like it had four segments that weren't, none of them were there. And then I think that selection only had two on it. And so you're kind of like, well, which one do we think they thought they were doing? And that's the only one that went back where we said, you have to correct this.
And did it take 20 years?
No, because it was so bad, they actually corrected it.
Well, and I was thinking, too, about the corporation lands and those easements that probably the people in the communities could tell you exactly where that trail was on the ground if it wasn't listed in the title, because they used it all the time.
Yeah, and I think they probably all assumed it was in the title.
Yeah. Well, and again, you know, the history of Native land ownership and use is a very long and complicated one.
Yeah, but I think whether you're Native or not Native, I think when land transfers from federal ownership to whoever, you assume that the travel corridor that you've been using for your community considers from time immemorial is protected.
Right.
Not that, no, by the way, they just made it, what we would call in lands clouding the title.
Right. And so that makes me think that, you know, for the people in the communities having this National Historic Trail, did it really matter to them? Because they were just using it anyway.
Yeah, well, and there's a difference between the Historic Iditarod Trail and the National Historic Trail, and difference in the easements as well.
Oh, and explain that.
So the Historic Iditarod Trail is going to be whatever trails were used within that system historically, and they're continuous, meaning there's a continuous route from, you know, if you're doing from Kinnick all the way to Nome. There's going to be a mail route or multiple mail routes going into these communities that we all know. And especially if they're going into mining areas, they're going to have RS-2477s on them. And those have continuous rights of way based on that law, meaning the Federal Reserve Statute 2477. The easements for the INHT, the National Historic Trail, are going to be put there for protection of a National Historic Trail. And so that will be, you know, for uses, but it might have, you know, let's say a negative easement. It might actually say, okay, it's going to be this way, that way we can move this trail should development occur, type of thing. It's going to be, you know, and based on the legislation that created it. Even if it's on state land, the National Trails Act doesn't apply to state land. It only applies to federal land. But state and municipalities and private owners can designate segments under the Act for the protection based on its National Historic Trail status.
It's very confusing.
Yeah, and that's what our litigation was for, so a judge could say, no, these are very different things.
Yeah.
You can have discontinuous easements on a National Historic Trail. Same with a scenic trail. And that is separate from the actual historic alignment, which may have a continuous easement based in an old 18th century law.
So, I still don't understand the difference between the historic trail designation and then what you're talking about, the easements that protect the trail.
Yeah. So you have, let's say, in this case, the Historic Iditarod Trail, which was, depending on where you are, like if we're in this area, it's going to also be the mail route.
Right. Okay.
So it would have been created on unencumbered federal land. So it will have an RS-2477 easement along it, which, depending on how old it is and when the land went into private ownership, whether it's 100 feet wide or something narrower, but typically 100 feet. So that has it as far as, but that's just a transportation route. So that's a access route.
Okay.
The easements for the Iditarod National Historic Trail are designating a route based on the designation of a National Historic Trail, but the easements are wider than what is needed for transportation.
Okay.
And that is done to also protect the historic integrity and to allow for things like within south of Anchorage and directly north of it, where you have development actively occurring, that you can have a buffer. And so you could still have a trail experience 20 years down the road once there's houses built everywhere.
Okay.
And roads crisscrossing. And so it's a different purpose.
Okay.
So the historic Iditarod Trail is an access easement.
Okay.
For community to community. You know, it was the mail route. It's people moved on it. Gold moved on it.
But it doesn't, having a historic trail designation doesn't give it the on paper protection that an easement does.
Yeah.
Okay.
So having the designation as a National Historic Trail does not even protect it on federal land as historic integrity, meaning if let's say you're on BLM land and, you know, let's say they own it and it's, you're in a trail and it's got it in trees and that's what you're used to and that's historically what it was and you're thinking as you're walking through there that this is what it will always be, and then one day you walk through and it's been clear cut,
right?
And then all of a sudden there's a house next to you and you're like, how'd that happen? And it's not having the National Historic Trail easement that allowed it to happen, because technically the access easement just is that.
Okay.
Access.
Okay. So when you were doing all this with the state easement unit, you were doing this National Historic Trail easement protection?
Yes. It depended on what trail we were on, because we also did do like the Iron Dog, which is just a pure recreation trail.
Right.
And we did parts of the race route that are not on the INHD at all. That would also be a hybrid one, so it depended on where it was. But we were also doing... But those were also access to villages, because typically where it's not on the INHT, it is going into a village.
Right.
That just wasn't within the management plan for the INHT.
Right. Well, yeah, you needed those little pieces to connect it all together. Okay.
Yeah. And where a village was historically might not be where it is today.
Right.
And so you need an easement to connect from the historic village to the current one.
Okay. And then we had talked about private property owners, how they felt about now having these conservation easement, trail easements.
Well, so there's no, it's up to a private landowner to designate a negative or conservation easement, just like it's up to the state to do it.
Okay.
No one can do it for that entity. So they might have an access easement or an RS-2477 easement for the trail across their parcel, or a prescriptive easement, or even a recreation easement, you know, depended on where you were on what it was. So that might be there, but those aren't conservation easements.
They're not as protective.
Yeah. And so a lot of it was education of, you know, a lot of private landowners thought, because the Iditarod Trail crossed their property, that meant it will stay a trail and they can just have fun watching like the race or other races come through and it will always be like that. And then we had to be the ones to go, well, actually it's an RS-2477, and technically somebody can request, propose a change in use. There is a full public process to do that, but it doesn't mean your trail won't sometime in the future become a road.
Even if it's on your private land?
Yeah. Because that's the RS-2477.
Came first.
Yeah, that is the senior right. And so that's called under the state regulation for how to manage RS-2477. That's a change in use, and ANILCA comes into play too. So you have to do it, somebody can't just decide, I'm gonna put a road through here.
Right.
It goes through a full public process. The state would have to sign on to do that. It's not common that it happens, because then you usually have to figure out where to put the people that are on the RS-2477.
Right.
But it can, and it does.
Well, yeah, I would think as a private landowner, if there's a trail there, you assume you know, I have control over it. It's on my land, and so it must get surprising for some people to find out, though maybe not.
Yeah. You own the land, but not the right of way. That is not, it's a right to a way.
Uh-huh.
Meaning the state or the fed, you know, whoever holds it, I mean, you know, it could be muni or right. whatever, has a right to a way across your parcel. And depending on how wide it is, it can morph, and they do,
right.
historically, change from trails to roads, and roads to highways.
Right. And so, talk about the process of working with private landowners to get them to give more protection.
Yeah. And so, for the private landowners where you had, like, just an RS-2477, or sometimes you would actually find road easements, but they were never developed as roads.
Uh-huh.
Meaning they were platting roads. You know, like if you look at a plat, it looks like there should be a road there, but you go there and it's just, no, that's actually the trail.
Right.
So it was actually already designated to be a road, but it was never made into a road.
Right.
Again, you would fall into the change of use, but it would be easier for somebody to change that use. And in that case, you're just then educating the landowner, like, oh, by the way, you know, and, you know, without trying to get them, riled up and to say, no, actually, what you think this does is not what it actually does. And no, it's actually what you call a trail is designated as a road. And yes, the borough could come in next year and make it a road because that's what it approved it as.
Uh-huh. And so were landowners supportive of changing and putting these easements in?
Some did, and some actually did put the easements in. And, you know, we sent them examples of if they wanted to do an actual conservation easement, because that, depending on where you live in the state, can give you tax write-off abilities by designating it that way. And so we wanted them to know that, oh, by the way, this could maybe lower your property taxes type of thing. Versus the actual access easement that the state, that you can just designate 50 feet and walk to the recorder's office for free. And then you can actually put in restrictions yourself in there. So if it's not designated as a road type mm-hmm. of thing, but you wanted to say, okay, I don't want this to become a road, you're welcome to put that in there. So it just depended, and some did. And then, you know, we did have, and it's a continuing problem of, you know, people coming in that don't, especially for RS-2477s, because they don't need to be in your deed, of blocking. And then us going out and educating that, no, you can't block it. And yes, it's certified. And here's where you find where that is.
Uh-huh.
And it depends, because we did have this, we have, you know, RS-2477s at this state tracks, and we know that they are, and we do have some that are actually went through the full certification process, meaning the landowners at the time, I think the state did this in like 1990, where they were notified everybody and went through the full federal process to then certify them. And then there's ones that are judicially certified, meaning they've gone to court and a judge has said yes. And so you have a mix of all those.
Right. And so if they've been certified or the court said these exist as RS-2477, the private landowner can't block it.
No.
Is what you're saying. They're protected.
It's already been legally determined.
Right.
And so those we just send them the documentation.
Said, by the way, you can't block this access.
Yeah. And the reason they didn't know it is because their deed doesn't mention it.
Yeah.
And so it's more of a thing of why you should get a title report when you buy property, because a title report should identify it.
Okay.
Or that there's a possibility that this...
Yeah, I mean, how many parcels along the whole Iditarod Trail are private?
Not that many. You're going to have some by the north, and then you're going to have some around Ophir and Iditarod that were patented mine claims.
Right.
Patented mine claims. I mean, Ophir, not I. And then, you know, then you're just mainly in communities or in South Central.
Right. You say the Matsuburo and old yeah. homesteads I could see.
Yeah.
Yeah, and around Rhone and up there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then what about native allotments? Were there quite a number of those?
Yeah, but those tended to have the 25, occasionally 50-foot wide easements because BLM or BIA is required to identify them. And that's the access, and then usually that's the access how they get there.
Right.
And so it's usually wasn't the native allotments that we had issues with. It, a lot of times it was more, did BLM make the same mistake on the state's title document? Did they do that to the native corporation documents type of?
Yeah, I don't know how much native corporation selected land is along the trail corridor.
It's quite, that's the biggest private.
Really?
Owners, yeah. I mean, it's like private, not native corporation owned that's not even 1%.
Yeah.
It's because we're talking very small parcels, so it takes a lot to get a percentage point when you're talking about that amount of mileage. But now the native corporation, I want to say it's like 10%. So they're by far the biggest.
Private owner.
Yeah. Private owner.
Right. And so have they completed this easement project?
No, we got most of the way done. I would say we got 80% done.
Uh-huh.
Before it was sunsetted.
Was the unit eliminated?
Yeah, in the budget.
Okay.
Like the positions went away.
If a different legislature decided to take the money away, or?
No, the positions were like line item vetoed away.
Oh, okay.
So one day it, I got notified of that, and so that went into, if they do that to your position, then you're allowed what's called bumping rights, and so then I had to go through that whole process, which I didn't do. I happened to, that's a separate thing of like being very awkward So what happened is, Cliff Larson is the one that hired me. Eventually, Cliff took the permit manager position, like 2 years later. And then I applied and was the manager of the easement unit.
Okay.
And then, and just before that, Ben Hagedorn then took a different position. And then I hired Christopher Minguez. And at that point, we lowered it to just like two people. And then I had assistance with, there were other trail positions within the South Central Regional Office. And then the one that did primary Matsu was kind of like the third person because so much of the stuff overlapped.
Uh-huh. And who was that?
And that was Kyle Kidder. But a lot of times he would, be the safety buddy of D's. K-I-D-D-E-R.
Oh, K-I-D-D, thank you.
And so it'd be like if we're actually going out to do trail mapping or we're doing work or inspections, he would be if we needed additional people, that's what he would come out. And then he helped out at the cabins, at Don's cabin and...
So what year did you become the manager? If you started in 2007.
Oh, well, I was in acting for over a year. So I'm trying to remember when, I want to say 2010, but I was in acting in 2009.
Okay.
But I could be, it could be that it got finalized in 2009, so I could be.
Okay. Somewhere in there. And Christopher, how do you spell his last name?
M-I-N-G-U-E-Z.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And so your role as the manager, that change type of work you did?
Yes and no. By then, we had done enough. I think it was, I don't think Christopher was just limited to, because he took Ben's position or mine. To like, okay, only sewer to, because by then we had enough of the big chunks that we could then divvy it up a little bit different. And then we were also doing a lot of management of state land by then. Basically, by then we had identified, okay, what like checkpoint facilities are there? What, roadhouses still exist, or are there safety cabins that are up here, and can we go in? Is there somebody maintaining these? And if the answer is yes, we need to go and get them under an agreement. And in some cases, the agreements could be free if you're helping to manage a state facility for free. There wouldn't be a cost for the management agreement because you're doing something the state doesn't have to now pay somebody to do.
Right.
And some of that, like around Iditarod, that was done, and some of the other historic cabins. We did have, BLM did build some new safety cabins. Right. And so those needed then communities because the state wasn't going to manage them. And so it just depended on which cabin, on what community, or if it was going to be BLM
right. That
managed it. And then doing agreements for all those. And so those are facilities that are still in use today, whether they were historic or not historic.
Right. So when the unit was eliminated, what year was that?
2015. So it ended June 30th, 2015.
Okay.
And... So while I went to water, so that ended up just with an odd running into the head of the water department and him saying, oh, I actually do have an open position. Would you like to just transfer over?
Yeah, I was saying you could do a lateral transfer.
Yeah. Type of thing. And I said yes, instead of, because it was very awkward with the, so my position, you know, when they do eliminate it and they try to figure out what you can go to after that. Mine had been written so oddly that they had a hard time finding comparables. And when they did, it was something that would require me to basically go to college to get a degree because the two positions, one was in, they were all in oil and gas. But one of them was, I think, royalties. And the other was like the auditor.
Oh.
For the royalty department. And I'm like, how? But I'm like, but I don't know how to audit.
Yeah, like, it seems like land permitting and planning, yeah. There would have been other things. Or your archaeology.
Yeah. No, it just had to do with like the odd way it had been written and coded, and it had actually probably been incorrect and no one realized it.
Yeah.
And now they're stuck with, this is how it's written.
Right.
And so I'm like, well, I don't want to be an accountant. And the poor lady who had the other one that, because when they do that, then they do that. Well, let's see if you would like go and meet. And of course it's always like this least senior she was like in tears.
Aww.
Like she was like just finished like her master's and like was horribly in debt, like a single mom. And so it was when the water department, I'm like, yeah, I'll do that.
Yeah.
Instead of putting this poor woman out of a job.
Oh, so you would have replaced somebody.
I would have replaced somebody.
Yeah. Oh.
And then she would have, and I wouldn't say she would have bumping rights because she was so new. She actually wouldn't. She'd just be unemployed.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
I thought it would be you have bumping rights to get an empty position. I didn't realize that it would.
No. Oh. It included filled positions.
Wow.
And it, now they would have, if they hadn't, they didn't have an empty at the time.
Right.
I think, yeah. And so that one, we said, this one can lateral, because I was a supervisor at the time, and this would be lateraling to a non-supervisor. It'd be more of a, I might a mentor, but not be an actual man, you know,
right.
Doing evaluations type of thing. And so I went ahead and did that. But the agreement with the water section and everybody did that at the time, so we were in active litigation, was that I would still be the what's called the client representative, meaning I was the person from DNR sitting next to the lawyer at the table for the Iditarod litigation. And that went on till 2018. So even though my position went away, I was still actively doing that for like 3 more years.
Hmm. And then, as you said, 80% was done since they eliminated the unit. Has any more work been done? It's just left at 80%. Nobody else has taken that on.
No. And I don't think they have the time or resources to do it.
Right.
That's what helped with having it defined that way.
Right.
And not only that, but when ours went away, all the trail positions went away. So there's no Matsu trail person. There's no statewide trail person. It was en masse, all the trails.
In the state.
At least in our regional, yeah, that all went away. And I think the justification at the time was, well, that's what adjudicators do. That's their job. So we don't need to have these niche ones. And it didn't really work out that way.
Well, that's what I say. Is there other state land adjudicators somewhere else in the state agencies? But
so there's easement adjudicators. And so the reasoning was, well, we have easement adjudicators. Just normal easement adjudicators can do this for all the trails.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you probably have to ask how that went for the other groups. But I know for other people, I kept getting calls for years because, you know, if you're an adjudicator that just does, let's say, water lines or driveways, that's not the same as let's do a trail from one community to another.
Right.
And so, no, to my knowledge, they haven't actually done any more.
Right, so they didn't pick up on it and finish it.
No.
And BLM hasn't been doing it. Because it's state lands, right, that we're talking about.
Yes. And in BLM, I don't believe has really done it on their land either.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So there isn't like a federal right-of-way. You'll have to ask them, but I do believe currently, it's changed over the years, but I believe right now it's because it's considered a conservation system unit, they don't need to.
Right.
Of course, being a state employee, I think a lot of state people say, yeah, but if you had done that, we would not have to do anything.
Right.
Because that right away would have come with the title.
Right. But yeah, as they say, it's a federal historic trail designation, and they see that that's enough.
Yeah.
On their lands.
And then that makes it on their lands, like a part of this system unit that they must do this for. Which is fine, except it's selectable land.
Oh.
So until all the conveyances are done, and I think that's where, and I know that, state lands, we kind of get frustrated sometimes because we're like, you know, we wouldn't have any of these issues had you just done it right away.
Yeah,
interesting. Because then we would all know.
Right. Oh, it's interesting that, yeah, as I say, you hear, oh, it's a, you know, National Historic Trail designation, you just assume it was all protected, and that was that. So
now the same thing falls to them, because had they actually gone through the actual federal process and made it a federal whatever right away, something that goes with the title document, then it wouldn't matter if it was native selected or state selected. That easement or right away would have gone with the title.
Yeah, interesting. So then how did you get involved with the Trail Alliance, and when?
So when I got hired, so the Trail Alliance has, you know, monthly meetings to where the land managers are invited to. So when I got hired as the state representative on that, we then went to the monthly meetings to give our little, you know, you'd give it like a little quick update of what you've done in the last month type of thing, or 2 months, depending on when it happened. And then, and that's how I was introduced to the Alliance. Mm-hmm. And they were also the awardee. I think they gave like $250,000.
To the easement unit.
To the easement unit. And then, you know, and then when you do have easements, you do give updates and what you've done to show them how you've spent their money.
Right.
And then in the end, I think, by the end, it had been almost like $400,000 that they had given.
Mm-hmm. So when did you get on their board?
Oh, that wasn't until 2017 or 18. So, you know, at the time, there's a rule that you needed to wait 2 years to do something that was sort of related to what your job was.
Right.
And since it was a nonprofit, most people said, no, you can go ahead and do it now. And then others were like, well, we don't know. And so I just went ahead and waited the 2 years so that there wouldn't be considered a conflict of interest. And then at that point in time, you know, I'm working in water, which doesn't relate to easements and right-of-ways. And it isn't part of OHA.
And so what's it like being on the board and what the Alliance has accomplished?
Well, it's pretty good. So I started out as the secretary. Right now I'm the treasurer.
So you did become an accountant.
No, we have accountants. I make sure the accountants are doing their job.
Right.
But no, I started out, I'm an at-large board member, uh-huh. And then I was quickly the secretary, and then I was the secretary for a few years, and then became the treasurer when the last treasurer.
So why did you decide you wanted to serve on the board?
I think to help them. They needed the assistance. At that time, they just needed a board member and a secretary. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I can take notes.
But, yeah, I guess what interested you in the Alliance and what they do and why you wanted to get involved?
Because I saw it. So at the, you know, when the Iditarod easement unit was up and running was also during the centennial of the Iditarod National, the historic Iditarod Trail. And so there were big programs and things at the fair. And so I could see all the stuff that they did and the money that they awarded and what they did on the ground. And I could see, you know, they award stuff to villages plus, you know, bigger things and trail groups. And I thought that was a meaningful thing to do. Uh-huh. And they asked if I would be interested.
Well, yeah, you'd obviously been doing all things Iditarod Trail for quite a while.
Yeah.
Before that.
Yes.
So, yeah, you knew the system, I guess.
Yeah. I think my first project on the Iditarod, I think, was 94.
And that was an archaeology?
Yeah.
So are there any particular Trail Alliance projects that you were involved with? You mentioned all these, you know, cabins and things, or there's ITREC.
I attended things for ITREC as the state employment was setting off because, so for ITREC, you know, they would invite the agencies there because they had like agency day with the teachers.
Okay.
So I would, be the state representative for that at the beginning ones. And so that would, and I think Cliff Larson also went to the first one, because they needed more than one person. Because that was when it was really big.
Oh, okay.
And you could have multiple teachers from the same school,
okay.
It kind of helped to not be by yourself.
Right.
On agency day, anyway. So we did that, and then we would go to the meetings, but we also helped out with doing something for the centennial, and I think that one the state decided to help out with the fair.
Okay.
To help them at their fair booth. And so that was the DNR, you know, assistance with, which just, we'll give you some bodies.
Right. And the trail people, those, you still had the trail positions too at that point?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the regional manager at the time, which was Rick Thompson when this started, you know, he was really for it and for all the assistance. And then we did win a national award. And so it was myself and him going to Washington, D.C. to along with the Forest Service. It was Jamie Schmidt and Judy Bittner was there to receive a partnership award for the state and the Forest Service and BLM working together.
On the trail.
On the trail and the not just the easement project and then the centennial, like all the stuff that we had done, but doing it working together.
Right. Mm-hmm. Which, is that unusual?
Yes.
To be working together like that?
Well, I wouldn't say it's not unusual to work together, but I would say at that level, that amount of coordination, yeah. Or at least I don't really see it. Yeah, I think unless you have the position dedicated, it's kind of hard because in a state employee, and same with a federal or employee, we just have so many other duties to
do. Right. So what are some of the other things about the Trail Alliance that you think have been positive? As you say, it's sort of, I kind of think of it as like the Friends of the Trail group. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's the nonprofit that speaks on behalf of the National Historic Trail. And it's the one that can actually get funds and stuff on the ground. So we're not, the Alliance doesn't do trail work. Like we're not, you know, heading a crew out there.
Right.
But we can, you know, we receive funds from BLM and from Congress through BLM. And that allows us, we can get stuff quickly. Two communities that the feds cannot. Federal entities have a hard time working off their lands, and in fact a lot of them can't. Mm-hmm. And so the Alliance, you know, every National Historic Trail will have a nonprofit established, and the reason for the nonprofit is to do what we do, which is to look at the trail system as a whole, not just one landowner's portion of it. And even though BLM is the administrator, it is still hard for them to spend money off of BLM land.
Okay.
Because they are, and so that means they can then pass the money to the Alliance, the nonprofit, and the nonprofit can then award and oversee the projects.
Mm-hmm. And that's how some of those new cabins got built?
No.
Oh.
So the new cabins was a different BLM project, and I think that was their ERA funds project, the Obama.
Okay.
You know, in order to put money into communities. So that, you know, that has a history itself, but no, that was different. That was just BLM's own project.
I thought there was one that was through the Alliance and it paid local people to work on building a cabin.
Yes. So the Alliance would provide the funds for like Shagluck to build the cabin. But the actual like cabin location was selected by BLM.
Right.
But yeah, because BLM couldn't pay. That's where that odd thing about federal funds and where you can spend them comes into play. And so if they're putting a cabin on state land or native land or whoever's agreed to put the cabin, if it's not federal land, then they have a problem.
Oh, okay.
whereas the Alliance can actually fund projects trail-wide.
Right. And do you know, like that, those, some of those new ones, were those the community said we want to put a new cabin, or we want to put a cabin here, or BLM said we need these cabins, or the
so for the
Iditarod committee said, I don't know where those would have come from.
So it depended. So the Carlson Crossing cabin, which is McGrath's cabin, that was a community, that was McGrath wanting a safety cabin along the Innoko.
Okay.
And that has been a long-term goal of theirs. And so that one was, well, we provided, the Alliance provided funds for them to do partially. They also did have the support of the city and the community to go out and do that. That's separate than like the ERA funding BLM project, where some of the cabins clearly were put where they needed to be, and then others, everybody kind of, I'm not sure. It almost looked like it was BLM's decision to put the cabin there. But it just depended on the cabin. But yeah, there's definitely, and there's other communities, the Alliance funded a new one out of White Mountain, the Topcock Cabin for White Mountain, not to be confused with the lower cabin out of Nome that's also called the Topcock Cabin. But that one was by far needed. The old cabin, which was an old BLM one, which is now on state land, it was in a state of disrepair. But it was also the cabin that has the most people saved out of it, meaning in it. So it was a very much a community effort from White Mountain and from the volunteer fire department, because they're the one pulling the people out of the cabins, and the Native Corporation. So the new cabin was built on Native Corporation land, and we awarded the grant to White Mountain Native Corporation. But it's definitely in an area very much needed.
So is it on the same spot as the old cabin, or they sucked it a
It's
spot?
Just up trail to where the ownership changes, and that way the Native Corporation could build it on their own land.
Right.
And designated themselves. And that one, it was just, I think, more of a, it's easier, because that way there isn't really permitting, because they're the...
Right, they're the landowner.
Yeah, just have to then supply the letter to the Alliance to say that, yes, we're in agreement and we will happily take this grant.
And then did the Alliance pay local people to do the construction?
That one would be, we awarded to White Mountain Native Corporation. I believe White Mountain paid the locals.
Okay. And the McGrath one, similarly, the local people were paid to build it?
Yeah, well, that one, it's kind of a hybrid, because it would have been, so the McGrath Trailblazer Group, which is the one that did this, is also the Park and Rec Division of the city of McGrath. So they, while they're all volunteer, they do have access to, like, insurance and things that would cover their project. And you'll see that in villages where, you know, people wear multiple hats.
Right.
And there's a couple other villages where, like, the trail group is then incorporated into the city.
Okay.
And that way it gives them municipal insurance coverage when they do projects. It depends on the group. So, like out of Shagluck, we did pay for the funds. Sometimes the Alliance doesn't award, like, they're still volunteers, so we're not giving money for time, but we do supply the money for the fuel.
The supplies.
Yeah, spark plugs for the snow machines. Occasionally we'll allow them to rent snow machines. It depends on what the project is and if they have them. But it just depends, because sometimes the Alliance is not providing actual funds for labor. It's everything else.
Okay.
And it's the everything else that in a village costs more than the labor.
Right. Well, as you say, like the lumber and getting it to the site.
Well, it's really in the fuel.
In the fuel.
And if they're using, like, their own snow machines, then we do provide money for the upkeep of the snow machine.
Right.
So it's going to be the filters, the spark plugs. And it's...
And what about their... Like, if they have to go camp out at a site, what about, you know, food and...
Yep, we'll provide the food. And that's... Feds can't provide food. That's another thing that comes up.
Okay.
So sometimes we'll provide, like, a little food budget, because we can do that. And in some villages, you know, it depends, because the city council might have the funds to, like, float it and then bill us. And then others, they're not. They don't have the funds at all.
Right.
To do even that. And so that we would then provide, like, okay, how much does it cost to buy a box of spark plugs? And
right.
How much are the filters and a belt? And how much is the fuel? And,
right. Well, it's interesting that, you know, there wasn't money to pay the labor, and people were willing to still go out and work on these projects, not as volunteers?
Yeah, and it depends on the community. Some we did have to provide something. But a lot of them, if they see a need for it, as long as you're paying for everything else, meaning
right,
all of the fuel, the food, you know, and all the maintenance for their machines, they don't mind volunteering. And they would like to volunteer. 'Cause it sometimes we don't have the funds
right
to provide. And it could be that maybe by us doing all the supplies and everything and the fuel, that perhaps then like a native corporation or something can then,
okay,
they can provide the funds. Because a lot of times we're working with multiple
right
entities. It just depends on the project, because some years we are lean on our funds.
Yeah. Well, I was just interested, like, yeah, how much support from the communities there is for the Iditarod Trail and maintaining it, and that they would volunteer versus, well, don't we do this if you pay me?
It depends entirely on the village. Well, and a lot of them, you know, this is the intervillage travel corridor.
Right.
And so if the project is to do a safety cabin that the volunteer fire department and the community has wanted for decades.
Right.
And our comment is, well, I'm sorry, but we only have this amount of money. We can't pay for the hourly wages, but we can pay for everything else.
Right.
An award. They don't then play hardball.
Right.
I mean, they usually then, they can find something, you know, like working with a corporation or the regional or the nonprofit, figure out something for.
Right.
Yeah, we've never had them say, you know, my way or the highway type of, mm-hmm. because it's for their community benefit.
Right. Mm-hmm. Are there things that you'd like to see the Alliance still accomplish in the future?
Yeah, I think now we finally have an executive director for the first time.
Oh.
This year. And so we can actually do, I think, much better outreach, because I think our name gets lost. Because I think a lot of people still confuse us with the Race Committee. And so if they hear us, they think we're race only. And it's like, no, we're in like getting it out to like to other villages and to all villages that, you know, if you have a big project, don't come to us. Meaning if it's $100,000, yeah, that's not us.
Right.
But if all you need is $1,200 to go and do some basic maintenance or to go and put wood at the safety cabin, yeah, we can do that. And quite easily.
Okay.
And it's not a hard process. and so, no, I think expanding that, I think now that we have an employee, we can expand that and do better outreach and better explanation of the differences between the groups. Because even in rural, people hear Iditarod and they think race.
Right, right. And I know there's been a lot of, you know, public education, interpretation, pamphlets and things like that. And I don't know how successful those are for, you know, that's for the telling people that this is a designated historic trail.
Yes, and a lot of ours are aging, meaning a lot of those were done for the centennial.
Uh-huh.
And so we do have a chance, I think, in the next couple years in this grant cycle with BLM, or award cycle, to actually update a lot of those,
mm-hmm.
and then see what we need to expand. But yeah, we do have a, you know, the awards from BLM occur in 5-year cycles.
Okay.
So even as the nonprofit for the trail, we do have to like redo
right.
the agreement every 5 years. And so ours goes through 2027 fiscal year.
Right.
And so we would have in effect a new agreement for fiscal year 2028.
And is it always a standard amount of money, or you guys have to request time?
So it's been stable the last 2 years, but it's no. So that's also been an issue with BLM, is that it's been very unstable. And so some years, it, like the beginning of this grant cycle, which was like 2016, no, 2022, like the first award was $15,000, and you're like, oh, you can't really award anything with 15 for 5 years.
Right.
That just means, okay, the board is, that's just going to cover board meetings for 5 years.
Right.
And getting together once a year, which we do. And so it takes a while with advocacy to say, you know, it's kind of like, well, thank you, but, and then when they do finally, let's say, okay, here's $100,000. They have a bad habit of, it arrives in September for that. So as we know, the last more than a couple years, the federal budget has been passed at the end of the fiscal year. So then right. That means a lot of times they don't award out until after that. And so what happens is the money arrives the last week of August or the first week of September, and then your ability to draw on it closes after the first week of September.
Oh.
So in effect, it's being awarded for that year, but you can't use it
right.
until the next year, once everything is unfrozen.
Right. And sometimes that doesn't happen till February.
Yeah. And so it's working on things like that where on paper it looks like, oh, yes, you got $150,000 this year. And it's like, well, no, we didn't. It's for next year.
Right.
And working on things like that is like, no, what we need is stability.
Right.
If you want us to really do great, you need stability of funding. Instead of going from nothing to huge awards, but huge awards arriving when you can't spend it.
Right.
And then doing this up and down, up and down. And the last 2 years, it has actually been stable. I mean, it was a little rocky in 2022, 2023. but 4 and 5 were stable. And
okay.
Which allowed us to actually hire the executive director. And that's the reason we couldn't hire one, was
right.
because of the instability. And so we did advocate to say, well, if you stabilize it and give us an award of a certain amount, we will then go, we can get one paid employee.
Right.
Because we do a lot for a volunteer board, but there's a limit.
Right.
And I think all of the volunteers can see all the great things we could do if we had somebody that could answer the phone during the day. Because right now, a lot of times it was, you know, everybody's working. They have other jobs. And so it's kind of hard to coordinate if you're trying to award grants and work with communities, especially villages, if it's like, yeah, I can only call you at 7 at night.
Right.
You know, 7 and 9 p.m. at night is my window.
Right. Or on the weekend.
Yeah. Or on the weekend. It's like, well, we work 9 to 5. And I'm like, yes, so do I.
Right.
Just not here.
Yeah. So now that you have this executive director, yeah, you're hoping to make some good progress.
For the outreach and having a stable contact.
Yeah.
Which, you know, while we tried very hard, we really couldn't because everybody had day jobs.
Right. And now with BLM, I don't know, do they have a trail manager?
Yes.
Because so, I know the previous one retired. So.
Yeah, so Kevin Keeler retired. You know, unfortunately, soon after that, before they hired a new position, that the Doge shutdown
right.
happened, or freezing, hire
right.
freezing. And so right now, we do have a new trail administrator, and that's Robin Lewis. And so she came up, I believe, from Denver, or Colorado anyway. And she was, she'd probably tell you her background, but I believe it's more scenic trails. But
uh-huh.
she does have a background in conservation system units, and she lateraled into that position due to being eliminated from her other position. And so Alaska is new to her, but she is eager and
yeah,
willing to learn. But there will be a learning phase.
Right, but I say that there's a lot of coordination that happens between the Alliance and the trail administrator manager.
Yeah.
It seems like from what I understand.
Yes. And to me, I look forward to working with her because this is the first time we've actually had somebody who has a background in conservation and trails. outside, I mean, that actually does conservation system units, uh-huh. which is what a National Historic Trail is. And so, you know, usually a lot of the other, you know, even Kevin, they come from a recreation trail background and don't really know how to mesh that with, it's a different type of learning process.
Okay.
So it's interesting to be the reverse of
it. Right.
But yeah, so yeah, we had like a year where BLM was kind of trying very hard, but with folks that their caps and different, you know, they had a lot on their plate.
Right.
And that's not to say that Robin doesn't also have a lot on her plate. And that's also occurring at the Forest Service where they have right. a lot of people just get fired. Well, but yeah, you do have Iditarod people there, but if they have to keep a visitor center open.
Right.
Is that person now at the visitor center?
Right. Yeah, other duties as assigned.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It,
are things, the other duties are becoming an issue, but, you know, we just work with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, be a sounding board.
So you see that the Trail Alliance has a future and will continue?
Yeah. I do. It'll be work. You know, I think, unfortunate for like the iTrek, that one will be more of a struggle because with coming out of COVID, so the iTrek got hit hard with COVID, right. and it went to more you know, online stuff, so a lot of the in-person teaching, and then right as we're about to do the analysis to then restart the in-person teaching, then all the people at BLM and the Forest Service either take early retirement or are fired.
Right.
And until that stabilizes, it's kind of hard for the Alliance on its own
yeah.
to do that.
You need those partners
yeah.
who are education people.
Specialists, yeah.
Right.
And otherwise, you know, we can contract. We have the contract for a specialist, but we then don't have anybody for her to coordinate with.
Right. And so the iTrek has been seen as successful, and you guys kind of want to bring it back?
Yeah, it's been greatly successful. But right now, there really isn't a path forward
okay.
without the we do need the federal partners there. It cannot be just the Alliance with a contractor.
Right.
We do need that. And, you know, and then on top of that, then just the budget issue in the state with education.
Right.
And that being in flux. And so I see that project having, you know, it's in more hiatus, I would say. And then it will need it. Some sort of plan to build it back up.
Right.
I will hope that it comes back.
Yes, and that all gets funded by the Alliance.
Well, and before the Forest Service and BLM, so it went in BLM, it went through the Camel Creek Science
right.
Center.
So I know they had staff working on it, so mm-hmm. they put some funding into it.
Yeah, so they did some funding for like through the Camel Creek Science Center. The Forest Service did some funding through also their equivalent of that.
Right.
Their interpretive and education right. department. But those on both ends have been gutted.
Right.
So I think now they're both, you know, just looking at, okay, we need to keep our visitor center open and BLM needs to keep the science center open.
Right.
That's the focus right,
right.
now.
Right.
It's not let's go out and do other stuff.
Right. Well, so how do you feel about having been involved with this trail and the Alliance for so long?
I like it. I find it rewarding. You know, I mean, you can see how things ebb and flow, and it can be, you know, frustrating if you're now in the ebb. you know, and remember when everybody was working together? But I think it's good overall.
Uh-huh.
It does provide a service, and a service that is needed. And if we weren't here, then BLM would be expected to do all this, but they don't really have the people and the ability to do it, especially off of BLM land.
Right.
So now I see us doing a lot. And I look forward, now that we do have an employee, to actually being able to do, like, all the wish list of things that we've always said, if we had an employee, wouldn't it be nice too?
Right. And who is that employee?
Betsy Oliver. So Elizabeth, but she goes by Betsy.
Oh.
With an I at the end of Betsy.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Okay. You can read upside down.
Yeah. And then, and she came on in March of this year, and it has been a learning curve, which we expected, but she's great, and she does have a background in education and outreach. And
great.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I wish the Alliance lots of luck. I say they're funding this project, so
yeah.
Hopefully we're getting some good documentation of the history of the designation and the organization. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we've covered everything. You have anything else you want to talk about?
No. I think, you know, if you haven't talked with Cliff Larson, you might, on how it got established, because he might have also more info on how the funds came and the work with Jim Palin before I was hired. Yeah.
Okay. Well, great. I appreciate your time this morning. Thank you very much.
Yeah.